Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 19th, 2005. This session, Aren't They All Catholic? Lutherans in Latin America. Presented by Anne Basie and Mary Campbell in the Creekside Room. Let's listen in.
Understand what transformation is, how to move out of traditions that I think keep us locked in, and to be more open to the Spirit and where God's leading us in our mission. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in, I guess my bias, I would think, is that perhaps the young churches are less fettered mm-hmm. by the tradition and maybe doing more innovative things, things that the Spirit's doing that would inspire.
Mm-hmm. Where's your church?
At Roseburg, Oregon.
Yeah, we're from Prineville, Oregon.
Oh, oh, you're from Prineville.
And our church is very wise.
And what brought you into this?
To this session?
Yeah.
Just to hear what's going on, because
in Latin,
you
know, I'm,
you always learn new things when you come home. You know, you're exposed to new things, so I'm just wanting to know what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. Great.
This is from Roseburg.
Oh, okay. And what's your name? You're Patty.
Patty.
Yeah. Okay. And this is Eileen and John. What brought you in to hearing about the Latin America churches this morning? What are your questions?
Just read it on the.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, what about you?
Well, I spent a summer in Costa Rica tagging sea turtles and really loved it. And I've always sort of had been wishing I could find a way to get back there. Mm-hmm. Just, I don't know. I thought I'd come listen. It's my day off.
That's great. And John?
Well, I've had a few sojourns in Latin America and am desiring to return in the next year or so. So, whenever that becomes possible, good conversation for me to be part of tonight.
Well, we want to welcome all of you, and this is going to be a very intimate conversation, and so you should feel completely free to interrupt me at any time, and to, you know, with any of your questions or things that might not be clear or things you want to hear a little bit more about as well. I thought I would start out just by reading a little piece from Like Grains of Wheat. This is in the bookstore, and this is about the experience in Central America, you know, which is one of the things we're going to talk about Latin America and the churches, kind of an overview, but we're going to focus more on the young churches in Central America. And so this book is written through the experience of people that were missionaries, people that visited, that were on delegations, people in all kinds of different places about it. And it's all about what they got out of it. And I'm just going to read you the beginning paragraph. On their journeys to Central America, the North Americans who crossed the southern border found woven into the fabric of life in community after community a dynamic faith rooted in the retelling, the reliving of sacred stories about God's loving engagement in human history, God's special love for the poor, and God's demand for social justice. Scripture stories came alive, took on contemporary form and meaning. Jesus Christ was incarnate in the villages of Central America, in the refugee camps, in prisons, in hiding places where frightened people clung with passionate determination to the hope that had come to shape their faith. And that's really my experience. So I wore my Romero shirt today because of that. Basically, the ELCA has relationships. I'm going to show you the map here. In all of the countries that are basically in the dark orange and the light orange. So you can see the Latin America desk. We have Latin America and the Caribbean. We really have three regions here. We have Mexico and Central America kind of as related together. We have the Caribbean, and actually Guyana and Suriname consider themselves, even though they're part of South America, to be part of the Caribbean. And then you have the South American churches. And I just thought I would start off by asking, who knows what's the oldest church in the region in Latin America?
Oldest Lutheran church?
Oldest Lutheran church. Hmm. Any guesses? It's the Lutheran Church in Guyana. 267 years old.
Really?
Yes. So even older, you know, than we are. So it's a small church, but it's a very strong church. It's a church made up of the Guyana is a very interesting place. It's East Indian and African. So the population at this point has become 51% East Indian and 49% African. And the Lutheran Church has those kind of percentages in it. I mean, so it's a church basically of that kind of a mix.
Can you go back a minute? You said you wore your Romero shirt, and I just saw that this morning at breakfast for the first time. It was a little boy, and the back of it was in Spanish, so I didn't know what it meant. So could you explain that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I will be spending some time when we get to El Salvador about this, because Romero, Archbishop Oscar Romero, was a Catholic Archbishop who is going to become a saint. You know, he's on the road to becoming a saint in the Roman Catholic Church, and really for Lutherans and for everybody who has a chance to be touched by what he stood for. He was a man who was converted by the poor. He was in Central America, in El Salvador, and who stood up for the poor. And as a result of standing up for the poor, he was shot. He was killed. In fact, there's a movie. Raul Julia played Romero in the movie. It was produced by the Paulist Fathers, but it became a very popular movie. And it was a movie that was so controversial that it couldn't even be shown in El Salvador until 1994. You know, and even now, I just went to the 25th anniversary of Romero. He was killed on March 24th of 1980, and on March 24th of 2005, there was a huge march and candlelight procession and a huge public outdoor mass, you know, with the Papal Nuncio of Central America there, and there was not even a line about it in any of the newspapers except for the one newspaper the next day. It is still so controversial by people. But he's going to become San Romero de las Americas, you know, and he's somebody for us to. He's a faith example, somebody I've learned about, and is really integral to the story of El Salvador and the Lutheran Church of El Salvador. Believe it or not, when we get to that point, so. You know, I'll be talking about it. So the person you saw with the shirt is my son, because I made him wear the Romero shirt today as well, because today's our Latin America day. So
I'll ask the next question.
You'll ask the next question.
What is the largest Lutheran church in Latin America, in this region? Anybody know?
They're big. They're big, aren't they?
Most of them are small, but one is very big and a lot like the ELCA. Mm-hmm. A lot of people from
Mexico, so.
Northern Europe immigrated.
No, there are several Lutheran churches in Mexico.
Argentina is maybe number two. It's Brazil, actually.
Okay.
Brazil has between 750,000 and
million. Oh, of course, Brazil.
Million members. It's like, a lot of them are German. It's a very, traditionally, we'll get to that later too, but traditionally it was a very German church, and now it is doing more.
Well, now's a good time. Say something about Brazil.
I got to visit the Lutheran Church of Brazil last year, and it was right after following a visit to the Lutheran Church in Peru, which was really a place where I felt, you know, like you, we were in this very, in these small worship spaces that we would say had nothing in them, but I just felt like compared to the 100-year-old churches that we sustain and everything is the same, I thought, wow, there really was kind of a freshness and an openness to transformation in Peru, because it just was so different from any church I'd ever seen. And then when we got to Brazil, it was sort of like, oh yeah, this is a lot like the ELCA. People were of German heritage and largely looked like us, and the churches were very settled, and the women's group of the Lutheran Church of Brazil is very strong and very large, and it seemed to be a church more like us, understanding that it had come out of a middle-class tradition and how would it serve the poor, as opposed to in Peru where everybody just was poor and was sort of serving each other. So, but the Brazilian church, it largely is centered in the southern part of Brazil where the German immigrants went, but it does have outreach to northern parts and works a lot in social justice through ecumenical groups trying to serve in areas closer to the equator, to the equator, that are more typically maybe Afro-Brazilian or more indigenous people. So that's the biggest church. Okay. Which Lutheran church speaks Dutch?
Yes. Which Lutheran church speaks Dutch in this region? So
you just said?
Indiana.
Guyana?
Curacao?
Or?
You're close. Suriname.
Suriname.
Yep. The Lutheran church in Suriname is a Dutch-speaking church. And and it's a very small church, and it's a lay-led church. Basically, they have one ordained pastor, and they have a lot of lay leadership, and they are looking, right now, they're actually looking for a missionary to come to help them strengthen their lay leadership and do some leadership training with them, an asset-based training. And this is one of the things that we're praying about in the LCA, that we will have candidates. And I just talked to Raquel Rodriguez, who is the director of our desk, and she says we have two candidates, surprisingly enough, people who can speak Dutch,
wow.
You know, who might be interested in this particular position. But it's a church, it's right across the river from Guyana, you know, and the people, and so some of the pastors from Guyana do come over there once in a while to be with them, but it's a very difficult trip. You can't just cross the river at any point that you want to there. And not only that, but there's the language difference that exists. So it's a very interesting place.
River crossing is because of government or because of obstruction?
It's because of the ferries only go in certain places, and because of the rain, sometimes the river can't be crossed, and then the churches are remotely located from the crossing sites. So one of our missionaries was serving in Guyana, and he used to try to go once a month, and it was a 6-hour trip each way. So basically, you know, he would do all of his Sunday services, run around, because in Guyana, they have these parishes that have sometimes 9 different worship points, and they can't do them all on one Sunday, so they start sometimes on Saturday night, or they alternate on some of them, but he'd run around and do at least 5 of them, you know, and then he'd get on and go across and do something in Suriname and try to come back the next day.
So he was really only a few miles away.
But
it
was a long, because of the way the trip was.
We were, my next question for you then, we were sort of going to do this conversational style is, so when the question that we wrote in our description, we think of South America as a hugely Christian place and largely Catholic, and it is a surprise for us to know that there are Lutheran churches of different sizes. So what is it that, you know, how did the Lutheran Church get started, and what is it that the Lutheran Church offers to a continent where we would think everybody would already be going to the cathedral?
Well, why the Lutheran churches, especially in South America, are the oldest ones, and they came out of missionary movements. In fact, one of the things that we can say with pride is that YELU, you know, the Lutheran Church in Argentina, came out of the United States in terms of being started. But they are definitely our companion now. There's no question of they feed us as much. You know, they are a place where we are learning new things about social ministry. But they came out of there's a Gustav Mueller from Pennsylvania who went to Argentina and started the church there. Other churches were started from different European bases. You know, in Chile, there's the Lutheran Church came out of Germany, and in Brazil, and in different places like that. We're going to get into the Central American churches very shortly, a little bit more specifically. You know, there used to be the old days where Lutherans carved up the world in some ways, made a decision about which place was going to be, you know, served by which Lutheran church. And Central America was left for the Missouri Synod. In fact, it was so strongly considered the Missouri Synod territory that even in the very beginning of the LCA back in 1988 and 89, I was privileged to be in a position where, you know, we had to have some conversation with the Division for Global Mission when I was just working in my synod, just a layperson, having to do with whether or not there was a pastor there who was about to lose her call because her status on the roster. And there was a question about whether we would even be able to roster her because this was still considered to be Missouri's territory. Imagine that. Even though these are independent Lutheran churches, they were all independent at this point in time. The question was, you know, could we be there? You know, and that's totally changed now. I mean, here we are in 2005 and we wouldn't even think about that anymore. But and so this was Missouri's territory. ELCA and our forebears, our forefathers, you know, mothers thought, you know, South America we could act more, and the Caribbean we could act. So why? What does the Lutheran Church offer? Well, in some ways there are two Catholic churches now. You know, it's all one in some ways. But there is the Church of the Poor, and then there's the long, long, long established church. And in some areas, you know, in the Lutheran Church is an alternative to the traditional, to the traditional Catholic worship. You know, not all of the Church of the Poor, the Catholic Church, has reached into all sectors of society. And people find the Lutheran Church and the doctrine and the freedom, and the grace and the way the Lutheran Church has acted in these countries to be enormously refreshing and a place to be. And our emphasis on the Bible, you know, and our emphasis on standing with the poor in this region has really made the difference, I think. We don't call it the option for the poor, but how many are familiar with that? Have you done any reading about the option for the poor? Well, it's you know something about that.
Just like read books.
Okay, well, that's pretty key, you know, to be able to know. In the Lutheran Church, like Bishop Gomez would say, the option for the poor is best described as the option for the most in need. You know, and he likes to say it this way. You know, when you're a parent, you love all of your children equally, but you may know that one of your children may need more than another one. And it's not that you love that child more, but that you might have to give that child, you might be more concerned about that child. You might be more, you know, trying to protect that child. And so there is a sense, not in all of the churches in Latin America, Lutheran churches, but in many of the churches, there is this feeling, the acceptance of the option for the poor. And there's definitely the work, you know, in the poor communities, because those are places sometimes that are forgotten. The churches might be the big, you know, the big cathedral that's on the town square. And, you know, you have these marginal communities, and it's not like in Latin America, it's not like here where the centers of the cities tend to be where people congregate that are really poor, or they end up. In Latin America, it's really the outskirts, you know, the marginal neighborhoods, and so pastors come and they minister to the in these communities in a very powerful way.
I just wanted to clarify: wasn't the relationship between option for the poor and Catholic liberation theology, right? It came out of some theological thinking from
Vatican II.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, it came out of Vatican II, but then it was made real by Medellin, which was a conference of the Roman Catholic bishops in Medellin, Colombia, and then Puebla, which is in Mexico, where it was clarified. And we just celebrated one of the anniversaries of Medellin. But Lutherans certainly have read this and certainly believe, you know, have validated that, you know, through their our theology, it fits as well. So. I guess unless there's any more questions on that, we will move on to just a brief sort of summary of you know, some of the characteristics of the churches. We're going to concentrate on Central America, but let's talk about South America for a minute so that you have some idea. You heard a little bit about the church in Brazil. And talking about the church, and we talked a little bit about Guyana and Suriname at this point. The church in Bolivia. This is a church of indigenous. I don't know how much you know about what's happening in Bolivia now. It's gotten into the news a little bit because there have been some strikes, and in fact, the president just recently resigned. The church in Bolivia is a church with the Aymara in there. And very, very strong ministry of leadership development is one of the things that they're doing. And taking Lutheran theology and being able to look at the indigenous beliefs of the Aymara and see the relationship between those two and working in. And so it has a lot to teach us about working in our own Native American context, the way they've been able to do that. The church in Argentina, as I mentioned, came out of the ELCA roots. How many know about the big crash that occurred in the Argentine economy in the year 2000? It was enormous. Basically, Argentina, the church in Argentina, and looked and still looks very much like the ELCA. Middle class people, for the most part. There are missions in northern areas, but very middle class looking people. Well, the economy totally crashed in Argentina, and people. And the church really had to be there for people. Soup kitchens were critical. And even now that the economy's recovering, Argentina's doing a little bit better, the church has really found its mission. The middle class Redeemer Lutheran Church, which is in the middle of Buenos Aires, is located not too far from where there was an old factory building. Factory went out of business completely, was abandoned. People who lost their homes have moved into that factory. And now Redeemer is ministering to those people in the factory. They're helping them get stabilized again. They're helping them to get jobs. They're helping them to make sure that their children can get education. Redeemer has a school that goes all the way up to high school. They're helping them, you know, with healthcare needs. And they're doing worship and Bible study there. So that's an example of how of their work. They're working in very, very rural, seemingly forgotten communities way up near the Amazon in Resistencia. And there's some marvelous, Pastor Raul is there, and they've got incredible work being done with communities that have no churches whatsoever there. These are people that know about God, but you know, don't have the experience of having been pastored to. Raul and his wife are there, and one of the needs they found was they needed health care. This community had no access to health care. So Rafael Malpica, who is now our executive director, was there one time. He made a call to Chile right from there, and there was a telephone, you know, in town to EPES in Chile saying, would you like to come over to Argentina and try to work with these people in an alternative healthcare model that has to do with promoters? So that's occurred. The church in Chile. This church, there was one Lutheran church in Chile at one time, and now there are two. During the Pinochet years, there were people that the church was standing with the government, the rich, and people were getting slaughtered. And there were people in the Lutheran Church that said, "I can't. This doesn't fit for me. You know, this. I can't do this." And it broke away from this. The German started Lutheran Church establishment, and became a church standing with the poor and the tortured, and it has continued to be our partner. There is the Church of the Poor and the people that have been tortured. There's a
a little bit similar to, there's a similar situation in South Africa where actually during the years of apartheid, one of the largest Lutheran churches was the support of apartheid, basically. And so a second church was created that was working towards social change. So again, there are two churches there, and the two churches that were sort of government are kind of I don't know if they're LWF members, but they're the old churches, but they're sort of unrecognized by partner churches around the world because of their political stance.
Well, and this church, the Church of the Poor in Chile, Yelch is kind of its initials and what it's known as, is a member of the LWF, and is one of the churches in Latin America that has a woman as president, Pastor Gloria Rojas. Another church that has a woman as president is the Church of Peru, ILEP. And why don't you say something about ILEP?
ILEP is a church that, like many of these churches, probably is 80 to 90% women and children. And I would say, just from my impressions of visiting at another place, I mean, the Catholic Church is very big, but for nuns there are leadership positions, but for many other women there aren't. So I think one of the fresh things that the Lutheran Church brings, and I'm not really that up on the Pentecostal movement, but I think some of the Pentecostal churches also are pretty hierarchical, aren't really that encouraging the women's gifts, right? The other more. So the Lutheran Church really offers that, and so the church in Peru has a big focus on education and economic empowerment for women and children in these, what they call barrios jóvenes, which we would say shantytown. Barrios jóvenes means new neighborhood. And, you know, the Peruvians are very proud. You know, this is a beginning neighborhood. In 10 years, this place will have sewer, electricity, water, and everything else. But we are creating it different from how we develop our neighborhoods and move into the house after the developer put all the infrastructure in. These are people who are building their own houses, and the infrastructure follows and eventually becomes part of town. But the churches are largely located in areas like that. And this was my second trip to South America last fall, but this time I was really able to hear a lot about gender, or género in Spanish, which is a really intentional effort that happens in development. So the NGOs who are working in development do this as well as churches, but basically, you know, for a woman to feel like she has any value at all, first you have to preach the gospel in a way that says, yes, you too are valued, and by the way, you have some rights, and you can file for your birth certificate and become a citizen, because the hierarchy is, it's so hierarchical that women really do in that culture of machismo suffer. And so it was interesting for me to see how the
so you said that church. One church is primarily women and children attending it.
Mm-hmm.
What about, don't you mission to the men too then?
Yeah, well, I think they do. The church that we split up on one Sunday and went to different congregations, and the pastor and the music leader were male. It was shared leadership, but the people who come largely were mostly women and children, but there were men there as well. They're not excluded. It was just, I mean, like my church on a given Sunday is, you know, probably 70-30.
They should be ministering to the men too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that they are.
But it seems like the women have come in first at this point in time, and women are taking the positions of leadership.
But children include sons, and sons grow up, and there is ministry then to boys and men as well. There were definitely men there. It was a male pastor in the church that I visited, which was very small. It was about the size of a container, you know, that you put on the back of the truck. It was like, you know, one of these new neighborhoods, and I just never worshipped in a place like that, where, you know, the wall didn't quite meet the ceiling. The floor was dirt. But it was a real worship service.
The spirit was alive.
It was wonderful. And really, comparing to my 100-year-old church in Chicago, I thought, wow, there's kind of a freshness here. You can sort of feel the wind, the Holy Spirit, on your face in a way that sometimes in our churches that we're sustaining, we can't. So.
Well, now we're going to look at the churches in Central America. And these are exciting new churches. Lutheranism in Central America is only about a little over 50 years old. In fact, while I was in El Salvador in 1997, that we were celebrating the 50th anniversary of Lutheranism in Central America. The churches that we're looking at here are in Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Costa Rica. In Belize, we don't have anything going on at this point. In Mexico, we do. Mexico is an interesting situation. There are a number of different churches in Mexico, and they do not relate to each other. There is no Lutheran Church of Mexico. So people are always saying, well, why can't we have a, you know, companion synod in Mexico or a companion church there? It is a number of different Lutheran churches that don't get along with each other, and so it would be the LCA choosing between them, and we're not making that kind of choice at this time. But we do have the strong work at the Lutheran Center in Mexico City. So that's Mexico, Belize. We're not involved. Panama, we were doing a lot of work up until recently, but we are not. We don't. There is no Lutheran Church of Panama that we relate to specifically at this point in time.
What was the work in Panama, and why did the work stop?
It was in rural communities. It was kind of community development work for a very long period of time. And it was one of these things that was started by some people that were there that then left. And then, you know, it sort of fell apart, and it was nobody came in to take it over and keep it going. Okay, as I mentioned, the history behind the Lutheran Churches of Central America was an LCMS missionary endeavor. What really got these churches off and going was, particularly in El Salvador, was the civil unrest of the 80s. You know, I mean, you remember all those times when we were hearing, and sometimes we didn't even know. I mean, it was the Sandinistas, and some people weren't sure which country they were in, and, you know, the and the gorillas, you know, and all of this stuff. But basically, what was happening there as a result of the Vatican II movement and is that that people were, the people there, you know, there's a big gap between the 14 families in El Salvador and the rest of the poor people, but that was the same way in almost every other country. Costa Rica is a little bit different. There's always been a different system there, a little bit more of equality.
The 14 families, that means 14 families who
owned everything, and then there was everybody else. And they had got a stranglehold on the people. And Guatemala, they didn't call them the 14 families, but there was the same kind of situation. It was even more underground because in Guatemala you have so many indigenous people that don't even speak the same language, and so the control was much more powerful, and it was much harder for the people of Guatemala to organize. Okay, the experience of the Lutheran Church in El Salvador. Yeah.
Are there still active LCMS missionary endeavors in Central America, or is that something they've had to curtail?
Well, There weren't any up until very, very recently. And now what I am hearing is, in a couple of different places, is now they have come back. And instead of looking at the church that's already there and being part of the church that's there, they're saying they want to do their own thing. So there's some things going on with that, you know, that are of concerns to the Lutheran churches that are in the area. So, you know, they were out for a while, but now I think they're coming back.
So how does that play into organizations like the Lutheran World Federation or, you know, Lutheran World Relief, where you have these member churches existing in Central America who are saying, wait a minute, the you know, LCMS is coming in here and starting other churches?
It's still at such an early stage that not anything much is being said. And the other thing that culturally is true is that there is such a sense of graciousness on the part of the people of Central America that you know, that if it was the United States, we'd say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't. But there's almost a let's wait and see kind of thing, attitude about it. So I think, you know, we'll see how that plays out. You know, but I know that even in the Lutheran World Federation, for other reasons, there's some other things going on that, you know, some other struggles, you know, in terms of the ACT Fund, things that show that there are all kinds of movements taking place. But basically, well, the experience of the Lutheran Church of El Salvador, for instance, you know, Romero, okay, here, and all that he said and all that he did to stand with the poor. Actually, he was Bishop Gomez. Bishop Gomez was raised as a Catholic, and that was his priest. He had a chance to know him. And when he saw this whole thing, it frightened him. He ended up becoming a Lutheran because an LCMS missionary said to him, he was going to try to become a priest. Couldn't become a priest because his parents hadn't married in the church. There was some rule on that. Felt very disillusioned, you know, because he felt the call. Met Robert Gusick, who was a missionary, LCMS, who said, I think you do have a call. Went to Lutheran Seminary in Augsburg in Mexico, you know, where it was. Came back to El Salvador, saw him at the point when he was, you know, speaking out for the poor and being killed, and it frightened him. You know, he'll say it just frightened him, you know, because he could see the prophetic nature of what Romero was doing. And when Romero got killed, people looked at him and said, we think that, you know, you're his successor. And so he said he started stepping out, you know, and then the Lutheran Church just grew by leaps and bounds, you know. So, and you'll see a little bit more about that. But, you know, it was the walking with the poor, and it's the walking with the poor all the way through. Focusing first a little bit on the Lutheran Church in Guatemala. Basically, statistics, you know, year was founded was in 1991, 12 congregations, has five missions, membership of almost 2,000 people. This is a mission with people in the cities and in some of the rural areas, and in the Petén is where the congregations are located. One of the things that's especially important is the work that they do with leadership. The women, because of the machismo nature of the society, have not felt like they've been able to even stand up for themselves or even be able to realize their value as a human being, and what one of the things that the women's ministry works on is self-esteem with them. If you see down there assistance for urban and rural poor and securing land titles, that is a hot issue right now. The president of the Church of Guatemala was recently arrested falsely because they're working in a community that the land situation is much different than here, where possession is 9/10 of the law in some ways. You know, we say that. There's a whole community that's lived on a piece of land that was abandoned for years and years and years. Well, all of a sudden now, a rich developer wants to offer the woman who has the title some money for this. And this community is there, so they've been in this big battle. So she just decided to have him arrested and charged. And so she got him dragged off to jail, and now he's facing a suit on that. And it's because he's standing with this community, and he's their representative. So he needs our prayers, as he is falsely accused, you know, in this situation. This is not a land grab, but it's a question of a woman trying to sell the land twice. You know, she gave it up, and now she can get a better price because another developer came in, so she's going to try to do something with him. An indigenous church? A poor church for the poor?
Is this a worship
marginal
space?
That's a church. Space? Yep, that's a worship space. With a very deep and contagious faith. And it trains the leadership starting from where they are. Doesn't have a whole lot of ordained pastors yet, but a lot of leadership development going on. We had a missionary that served there for 10 years, training people in Lutheran identity. What does it mean to be a Lutheran? And providing for the leadership for tomorrow. Lutheran Church in El Salvador. Actually, I think it was probably the date is 1947. A large number of congregations. Special ministry emphasis. I guess I would say one of the things that I have always felt strongly about was the Human Rights Office, because I actually worked there for 5 years. One of the things that attracted me to the Lutheran Church in El Salvador is having a human rights office that actually tries to train people in what their rights are, because most people don't know, and empower people like promoters to help people resolve legal questions, and really work with children as well, so that children understand that they have rights. That's one of the very, very strong ministries of the Salvadoran Lutheran Synod. This is, yeah.
When it says missions, what does that mean? Is that the 2,000 member church had 5 missions, the 15,000 member church has 6 missions. So what do you mean by mission?
Well, usually the missions are places, are communities where the church is sending someone in to do worship. There's not even a church built there yet, but it's kind of the outreach work.
See, the smaller church is doing much more outreach than the larger church in terms of what its emphasis is, it looks like.
Well, the missions are, let me back up maybe and go back to that. Okay, there's the 60.
Is it because there are more established congregations? Or?
Yeah, there's a lot of established congregations. The missions that they have going are outreach preaching points, you know, at this point in time.
That's so the 62 churches are supporting the 6 growing ones.
Well, and the 62 are also, you know.
Many of them are also still
are
missions.
Missions in one sense, but they're more established than where the building and with the congregation, and when, you know, they have.
Well, just because it's 62 congregations, but still only 15,000 active members. It's a congregation well established, but it's not a congregation like we would think of it here in the United States as far as numbers, probably.
No. I mean, some of those 62 as well are places that this was as of last year, the new areas that they moved into. where they were not, they hadn't worked before. The earthquakes of 2001 brought about a lot of opportunities for them to minister in new communities, and some of these are in Ouachapan, where they did not have a lot of activity before. So that's where those are located. This is very interesting, the subversive cross. This, during the war, one of the things they did is they wrote the sins of society on this subversive cross. This church was bombed the same day that the Jesuits were killed, on November 16th of 1989. This church was bombed, and the Salvadoran military came in and took this cross. And it actually ended up in the home of the president as judgment. And Chris Grum, who was then vice president of the ELCA, and a couple of the bishops, including our own, which at that time was Peter Rockness, actually had to go to the Ministry of the Exterior, where the cross ended up, after traveling around a few times, to ask on behalf of the Salvadoran Lutheran Church to get that cross back. So basically, it talks about selfishness. It talks about failure of community. It talks about failure to love your neighbor, you know. It talks about the killings that were going on, the kidnappings. All of that is written on that cross. But that was, so that's the subversive cross.
It ended up in the home of the president of El Salvador?
Yes, yeah, it was there for a while. I mean, it traveled, then it ended up in the Ministry of Exterior. So that remains in the church today to remind people of that period of time in their lives and what they went through. And it's the sins of society. When we go up to it and we read it, we see, you know, that as well. One of the reasons they broke away from LCMS was because they promote women as pastors, and that was not going to be possible. This is Abelina Gomez, which is the bishop's wife, who is one of the ordained women.
They've both been here to Holden during Arbrietas 2 years ago.
And they're the ones who told me about Holden. They love this place. They have an intentional commitment with the poor, working in very, very marginal communities. If you talk to people from the Catholic Church there, they'll say, wow, you know, the Lutheran Church is on the edge, you know. And it's neat for us, because here we are, we're so establishment here, to be in a place where we're on the edge. The right of children is very important to them. And there have been a lot of recent crimes since the war of children being kidnapped and killed. And one of the things that they've tried to do there is a very, very strong outreach among the children, education, so that they know their rights, and also and they speak up when in threatening situations, and that they be in solidarity with each other, you know, when adults aren't always present. But I was present recently at a really wonderful event where the children wrote some essays, you know, just very small children, about what their rights are, you know, and the fact that they wanted that their rights were going to be respected. Honduras, very young church, going through a change in leadership now, which is very exciting. A pastor, LCMS pastor from Guatemala, was there for many years as the president of the church. And they've recently had an election, and because they don't have any ordained clergy of their own right at the moment, they have a bunch of people close to finishing. They have a missionary from Brazil who is the president of the church, but he only is holding this office until they can move forward and elect their own leadership from within. It's a church founded in 1983, 9 congregations, 9 missions. A lot of emphasis on urban youth ministry in urban areas with gang violence. And you may have heard something about the gang violence that occurs in Honduras. A lot of work with the youth, a lot of empowerment. And Anne, you were going to say something about what Lindsay Mack, our missionary who works with the youth, wrote a story.
We have a young missionary who's worked there with the young leadership, and they hadn't, their youth ministry was kind of dormant, and they hadn't had like a national youth gathering or any kind of gathering for youth in a long time. So they worked together, the youth, to plan their own gathering, and they held it a year ago, and it's just transformed their youth ministry. And their youth goes to like 30, right? It's young adult. It's not really just teenagers, but they're definitely people who can lead in the church. So her work with the youth is really strengthening a whole bunch of new leaders.
And those youth, at the time of the assembly, asked that they be allowed to vote, you know, when the elections were being held for the next president of the church. And the assembly vote granted them the right to vote. And so they voted. And now, Ruby, one of their diaconal leaders was just in the United States, and she just said it was just a moment of, you know, being able to take the future for them, you know, to feel like, well, this is our church. They have given us the right to vote. They really care, you know, that we're members. So it's a very strong ministry and very motivated for the future. And by the way, that's a position, Lindsay's position will be ending. She's coming back next January. That is a position that's posted, and we're looking for somebody to take her place, because to continue to work in youth ministry and in communications. One of the very key things she does is when delegations come from the United States, she acts as their translator, and she helps them, you know, to work, and she takes them to the community so that they can visit. Rural ministry. And that's Guillermo Flores, who was the president of the church. Teaching occurs where it occurs. And here again, most of the members of the church are women. Very strong, there's the youth group, very strong youth ministry. There's Guillermo Flores, the former president, and his wife, who they were the only two ordained people that the church had. So.
Yeah, you said he wasn't LCMS then. If his wife is ordained, or how did that work?
Well, he was until he, but then when the church liberated itself,
okay,
she could be ordained then. So yes.
Okay.
Leadership training, very key.
Nice
for them.
Intrigue.
Yeah. Okay, Nicaragua. Now, this was a mission church that was started by Salvadorans that fled to Nicaragua during the war. And the bishop of the church is a Salvadoran. And it started in refugee camps of Salvadorans in Nicaragua. And now has a very vibrant ministry. And Anne was going to say something about that.
The man who is our regional representative for Central America and Latin America wrote a really wonderful story about visiting a town called Aguas Palapa, which was far, far in the mountains, hard to get to, like a lot of places here. So he went to worship with the local Lutheran church, and they worship in a very large warehouse. And, you know, so he said to the pastor, well, tell me about the space. You know, there's a little smell here. What's this warehouse for? What was it before it was worship space? And the pastor or worship leader said, well, this is where we stored the chemicals, the pesticides that we use on the cotton crops. Well, isn't that kind of dangerous? You know, North Americans, we wouldn't worship a space like that. He said, well, no, for us, this building has an entirely different meaning, because this is the building that saved us. So what had happened was, during Hurricane Mitch, the warehouse was the highest place in the village, and everybody in the village climbed to the top of the roof of the warehouse and sat there for 3 days. While the flood took away, you know, their animals, they watched their boats float by and their cows float by. And then when they came down, the group that came to help them was the local branch of the Lutheran Church, probably with funding from the ELCA, because before the tsunami, the Hurricane Mitch disaster was the last really big significant disaster that Lutherans were really generous about. So the numbers are now dwarfed by the response to the tsunami, but prior to that, Hurricane Mitch was the largest instance of generosity from us through LWR. So the local Nicaragua church, with some international money, had come in and aided this congregation. And so they turned it into a church and made it Lutheran. So, you know, for them, it's a symbol. You know, they said, the only people who came to help us were Lutheran. This is the building to sustain us, and that is why this is our Lutheran church, and this is where we gather. So it was a very powerful story of the meaning of the church to people in that area.
They call it Fe y Esperanza, because that was the name of the refugee camp. So that has maintained itself. And that is where the cathedral of that church actually sits, is on that same refugee camp site. You know, that's a community now.
Fe y Esperanza means faith and hope. So it's the Lutheran Church of Faith and Hope.
I think there's a photo display in the village center on this, isn't there?
No, that's on the Lutheran Church of El Salvador.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Youth ministry, very key. A lot of work there. And education for children is a priority. One of the beautiful things about the church in Nicaragua is the Bishop Victoria Cortez has made it a priority for the children to know what it means to be Lutheran. And so even little kids can tell you what it means. There's no doubt about it. Enabling basic needs. And there she is in the middle. You can see her. She is a powerful preacher. When she gets going, she's incredible to listen to. Lutheran identity beginning early in life. And but there's a lot of joy. Okay, the Lutheran Church in Costa Rica. This is a church founded in 1988. It has 8 congregations, 17 missions, and 1,100 people. This is a church that does a lot of children's ministry with immigrant and indigenous communities, a lot of work with indigenous communities as well, and actually has a legal assistance program for indigenous people. That's been very important. One of the exciting pieces that I would like to talk about is the Soccer for Life program. Well, you know, in Central America, soccer is just giant, giant. And one of the ways, one of the things that we have done is through the LCA has we sent a woman there who was just a passionate soccer player. And she worked with some of the church leadership there. They started a program for children and youth at risk in marginal communities. And because of her skill at playing soccer and the skill of some of these other really good leaders, they've organized teams, soccer teams and training. And these kids are really tough competitors. They're winning all kinds of tournaments. But the beautiful thing is, you can't be in this program unless you are following through with your schoolwork. You know, part of it is making the grade in school. And part of it is the way you are in your family. You know, if you're participating in your family, you're participating in your church life. So there's a whole thing that goes along with being part of this soccer program. And those that that follow through on this come out as winners. They've even got their own video, which we can get you in touch with so you can learn more about it. But this is a situation of a woman with a passion for going to do some children's ministry, passion for soccer, seeing the connection, and working with the right leadership and making something really incredible happen. And now soccer teams from the United States are sending them equipment and all materials, and it's really a great thing. As I mentioned, legal assistance for indigenous people's rights. And they do a very strong ministry with Nicaraguan immigrants. Nicaragua, probably know that, has a very, very tough situation economically since the war. In fact, they were one of the countries that was actually offered the debt forgiveness. And so there are a lot of economic immigrants to Costa Rica, and so the church is working with them. Children's ministries and immigrants and indigenous communities. And then they have this wonderful Centro Manu. If you wanted to go to Costa Rica with a church group, they have a retreat center that is available at a very reasonable cost in a very beautiful location to have a retreat. Worship in indigenous communities. Basically, to summarize this, to be Lutheran in Central America means to make an intentional commitment to be the church of the poor. Thanks be to God. We're really out of time. The bell hasn't rung yet, so we won't be able to do much more than that. But we wanted you to take something away from here. One of the things that the World Hunger Program and the Vision for Global Mission has done is put together a whole...